This is Catherine McNamara, editor and publisher of Archipelago.org, an international journal of literature, the arts, culture, and politics. On March 25th of this year, at the Virginia Festival of the Book, Archipelago sponsored a civic conversation, The Virtuous Republic, with the historians Mark McGarvey and Barbara Clark Smith. I was the moderator.
I'll introduce the panelists this way, starting with Mark McGarvey, who earned the J.D. and a Ph.D. in history and has completed a postdoctoral Golieb Fellowship in Legal History at NYU School of Law. His specialties are the intellectual and legal history of early America. He has taught at SUNY Buffalo, at the SUNY Buffalo Law School and the William and Mary School of Law, and is currently in the History Department at the University of Richmond. He has published about a dozen essays in law reviews and academic journals, and two books, Charity, Philanthropy, and Civility in American History, and One Nation Under Law, America's Early National Struggles to Separate Church and State. Dr. Barbara Clark Smith is a curator at the National Museum of American History, the Smithsonian Institution, where she specializes in the history of politics and movements for reform. She has curated major exhibitions at the National Museum, including After the Revolution, Everyday Life in America, 1780 to 1800. She has published scholarly articles on the participation of both women and men in food riots during the American Revolution, this in the William and Mary Quarterly, and most recently on forms of political participation in colonial America besides the vote, this in the Journal Early American Studies. Her essay entitled The Freedoms We Lost explored the changing meanings of popular consent in the revolutionary era. This was published in the February-March 2004 issue of the Boston Review, and it might be available online. Yes, if you go to the Boston, Google Boston Review. She is currently working on a book on the topic of forms of liberty enjoyed by subjects of the British monarchy in 18th century North America that became unavailable to citizens of the new United States in the 19th century. It will be entitled The Freedoms We Lost, A History of Consent in Revolutionary America. And she needs to say, or asks me to say, that the interpretation she offers here today does not express the opinion of the institution for which she works. And so may I give you then a preamble before turning to Barbara and Mark. Last summer, two friends and I were driving through Orange and stopped and went through the James Madison Museum there. And then we're very interested, and on the way home, one of our number talked about John Locke and his philosophy and various aspects of it, which we found remarkable, and how Locke influenced certain of our founders. And we realized that perhaps this was just the time to read the Federalist Papers. So we did. That was going to be our summer project. So I found a good, cheap, this is the ideal form of a book, a good, cheap book. This is Gary Will's edition from 1982 of the Federalist Papers. You can get it for, I think, $7. With not only the Federalist Papers, but his very interesting and interesting introduction. And a passage from that introduction interested me very much. It told me things I didn't know and wanted to learn about. So may I read you this, and then at the end, I'll turn the panel over to Barbara and Mark, and they will carry on. This is from the Federalist Papers, Gary Will's introduction from 1982. It's published by Bantam Classic. This is Gary Will's. The text of the Federalist Papers does not support the view that either Madison or Hamilton took a predominantly dark view of human nature or the American people. Both men, on the contrary, attacked their foes for being too jealous, suspicious of power in a more efficient government. This does not mean they were Pollyannas about human nature. Madison said in number 51 that if all men were angels, we would need no government. And both men admitted that a corrupt people can exist, making for a government that would accommodate their weakness, for a tyranny where only fear can reach people, or for an aristocracy where no higher value than honor is accepted. In this, Publius was following the teachers of Montesquieu, who said that a republic is only possible when the people are virtuous. And both Hamilton and Madison assert that this was the American's happy situation. Asking himself whether the people can be relied on to choose virtuous rulers, Madison answers, "I must own that I could not give a negative answer to this question without first obliterating every impression which I have received with regard to the present genius of the people of America, the spirit which actuates the state legislatures, and the principles which are incorporated with the political character of every class of citizens. I am unable to conceive that the people of America in their present temper or under any circumstances which can speedily happen will choose and every second year repeat the choice of 65 or 100 men who would be disposed to form and pursue a scheme of tyranny or treachery. Were the pictures which have been drawn by the political jealousy of some among us a faithful likeness of the human character, the inference would be that there is not sufficient virtue among men for self-government, and that nothing less than the chains of despotism can restrain them from destroying and devouring one another." Madison voiced the Hobbesian view only to counter it in the Federalist and at the Virginia Ratifying Convention, where he said, "I go on this great Republican principle that the people will have virtue and intelligence to select men of virtue and wisdom. Is there no virtue among us? If there be not, we are in a wretched situation. No theoretical checks, no form of government can render us secure. To suppose that any form of government will secure liberty or happiness without any virtue in the people is a chimerical idea. If there be sufficient virtue and intelligence in the community, it will be exercised in the selection of these men, so that we do not depend on their virtue or put confidence in our rules, but in the people who are to choose them." Gary Wills says, "At the ratifying convention, the fear of power was expressed by the opponents of the Constitution, not by its defenders. Hamilton had already attacked that fear as the extravagant surmises of a distempered jealousy. And he contended, "The supposition of universal venality in human nature is little less an error in political reasoning than the supposition of universal rectitude. The institution of delegated power implies that there is a portion of virtue and honor among mankind which may be a reasonable foundation of confidence." And Gary Wills ends, "Yet this enlightenment optimism about man's power to use reason in the service of progress just more insistently raises the question, if the people are virtuous, why distrust them? Why check their sovereignty?"
I think I'll reflect on Madison and Hamilton and Catherine with some remarks. First, a few background notes about virtue, and then I want to look more carefully at aspects of the Patriot movement's ideal of American virtue in the 18th century, looking at the resistance movement from roughly 1765 to 1776, and finally, briefly in closing, suggest some ways that ideas about public virtue developed through the Patriot movement in those years figured in the divisions over the Constitution of 1787. Well, virtue was a pretty significant concept in the 18th century, and it was an ideal central to dissenting traditions of English thought that circulated both in Britain and North America. Within such traditions, virtue primarily meant overcoming self-interest, putting the well-being of others, one's community and one's neighbors and countrymen, before one's own. Virtue resided in the social bonds, the links of affection, reciprocity, and fellowship, what we might call horizontal connections, bonds that assert commonality over all the differences that a hierarchical society might encompass. In the case of elected representatives in the House of Commons or in the provincial legislature, such as the House of Burgesses in Virginia, virtue meant pursuing the interests, and if you were really radical, possibly even the desires of your constituents, rather than one's own private and particular profit, or the advantage and profit of your own family or circle, or even your own wider social class. Virtue was necessary in this theory because of the power of interest, the great lure, and the seductive trickery of the mighty self. Men liked power and money, or so 18th century people had noticed, and they saw that injustice in their society and the marketplace and tyranny in government administration were apt to result from that liking. In this perspective, oppression, which was tyranny exerted either by rulers over the ruled or by the rich and well-positioned in the market over the poor and disadvantaged, such oppression was not just a possibility. If it was not quite the norm, it was a reasonable expectation. And to fend that off, virtue was incumbent on individuals and on the society and the nation as a whole. Now, I think in specific 18th century terms, the opposite or contrary of virtue, speaking in the realm of politics and government, was called corruption, which is to say putting self-interest before the obligations beyond the self. Legislators or representatives could be corrupted in numerous ways, having to do with position and honor, and especially with money. A legislator might be appointed to a lucrative office by designing ministers to the monarch, cut into a share of the spoils, admitted to the circles of power and influence by the executive power. By that means, a representative could be induced to cast his votes in Parliament for administrative designs rather than his constituents' best interests. Hard to imagine, isn't it? In England, a fair number of political and social critics wrote about the corruption of the polity and the society at large. Their idea of political virtue and their constant concern about its waning and the growth of corruption took place in the context of the development of what the historian John Brewer calls the fiscal military state. As many contemporaries recognized, Britain's rise to power in the 18th century was in large measure a function of its capacity for sustained and often distant warfare. And as the great Cicero had told everyone, there was something that was necessary for that. The sinews of war, he said, are infinite money. The capacity to get money for the government through an ever more heavy tax burden and a radical increase in taxation was made possible in 18th century England in part through the development of public deficit finances, that wonderful invention, the national debt, and on an unprecedented scale. Also was the growth of a sizable public administration devoted to organizing the fiscal and military activities of the state. And the development of that state was central to Britain's power, empire, and glory, not least because as the government increasingly tapped the resources of the moneyed classes and new banking institutions, it could pursue even unpopular wars, distant wars that didn't mean anything to the average English person. For now, the crown did not rely on taxpayers as a whole to show their approval for his ambitions, but merely to rely on taxes to service the debt, that is, to pay off the interest. This limited the reliance on taxpayers' immediate support. And the approval that the people gave the monarchy or the ministry was no longer as powerful. It gave the monarch space for pursuing policies despite the people's lack of support for them. This system certainly entailed prosperity for many in the midst of this empire, tremendous unprecedented riches for a relative few, and perhaps related, massive poverty in 18th century England, including a new and particularly troubling problem of the laboring poor. That poverty, along with the size of government, its many offices, its close ties to the wealthy, and their obviously growing fortunes and opulent way of life, government's growing distance from ordinary middling Englishmen, this looked to some dissenting writers of the time like something you'd call corruption. Now, in British North America, people were familiar with these worries about corruption, but in fact they had very little experience of the fiscal military state. When, in the 1760s and 70s in particular, They did begin to have greater experience of it, of its need for money to service the debt, and its readiness to circumscribe the arena for popular consent. They responded by rethinking assumptions that they'd held for a long time about how virtuous Britain was. And they also rethought the virtue of their own societies as well. It was that rethinking that created a patriot identity in the years 1765 to 1776. So now I'm going to just look briefly at one aspect of the patriot movement during those years in order to look at what were these ideas about British virtue and now American virtue. Specifically, I'm going to look at the trade boycotts that were increasingly central to the resistance movement. In these years, colonists petitioned the king and parliament, and they wrote pamphlets to convince each other and the English about their rights and their wrongs, and they orated from the bench and the pulpit in countless town meetings and other public forums. But in one part of the movement, they expressed a powerful notion of virtue. These were the agreements to suspend trade, and they were formed in response to the Stamp Act in 1765, the Townshend Act in 1767, the Tea Act in 1770. You see, I did my exams. The Tea Act of 1770. And then when the First Continental Congress met in Philadelphia in 1774, they did what everyone expected. They formed a trade boycott called the Continental Association. Well, these associations or covenants or agreements over time became increasingly participatory, comprehensive regarding the goods that were going to be boycotted and the elements of life that patriots would regulate. They became less and less voluntary and more coercive. In terms of numbers, the boycotts were the element of the patriot movement that most people actually joined. The elite could write or stand up in the House of Burgesses and state their opinions. Most ordinary Americans could enter a boycott of trade. Therefore, the boycotts engaged not only the elites, but ordinary voters, and for that matter, non-voters, men of limited property, youth, and even many free women as well. In fact, that document, the Association of 1774, the trade boycott, I think that might be the first American document to refer to political participants not only with the masculine pronoun, but with the feminine pronoun, although they use not the form she, but the form her, talking about what will happen to those who don't follow along, what will happen to him or her, what's our disciplinary actions. But nonetheless, these boycotts could safely omit only those people who had no trouble limiting their own consumption, limiting their own importing and exporting, namely the unfree, either the very poor who were free or the very poor who were enslaved. So in terms of location, these boycotts were central. I think they were the very hub of the movement because they're a kind of key point of intersection. They're the place where those who wrote and read the learned pamphlets and those who mobbed and tarred and feathered the customs commissioners all came together and stood on the same ground. Everybody had to join in order to be a patriot. And this is where they made their coalition across lines of class, region, interest, and belief. Here was the common element of what we often call the common cause. What this meant was, briefly, joining one's neighbors in a boycott of imported goods, purchasing or producing homemade, according to your social status, purchasing if you were of the purchasing classes, producing if you were of the producing classes. Dealing only with others who agreed to deal according to the terms of the agreement and within the same limits, boycotting everyone else, ostracizing them socially, accepting vulnerability to public oversight of your practices of buying, selling, putting prices on goods, things as small as drinking tea, things as large as profiting at the expense of your neighbors. As far as impact or purpose of these boycotts, from very early on, they faced in two directions. Initially, they faced towards England. They were a way of convincing the merchant houses and manufacturers there who would see the drop-off in their trade to lobby Parliament to repeal offending laws. They were also meant to have an impact on American societies. And in fact, the newspaper arguments for them, as the historian Edmund Morgan has pointed out, hardly talk at all about how this will affect England. They talk about how fabulous it will be for the colonies to reclaim their virtue by giving up imported goods, all those baubles and trifles and expensive things, and making them themselves or purchasing them from your neighbors who have made them. Over time, there is a shift. There's an effort to remind your English brethren, and that's how they speak of them. That word, I think, is important. These people who, with whom you feel intimately connected, remind them that our fortunes are bound together, that we have horizontal ties between us. They're bonds of reciprocity and exchange. You should deal fairly with us. Surely England would remember and feel for the plight of the distressed colonies. As England apparently did not feel for the distressed colonies, based on policy, increasingly many inhabitants of British North America made themselves Americans. That is, they took on a new identity by deciding that perhaps Britain was not such a virtuous society. Perhaps colonial societies, ultimately only but all of 13 of them, were the virtuous ones. People made the connections of economic exchange, mutual affection, and fairness among themselves, among the group of people they came to think of as Americans. Well, briefly, here were the basic principles then of virtue and patriotism in these years. We would reformulate, as patriots, relationships with one another. In particular, they would reformulate relationships of social class. Elites should stop attending the theater. So should everyone else, but it's the elites who got to do it most. Elites should stop holding fashionable tea parties in private parlors. They should stop flaunting their money and encouraging their social inferiors from wasting theirs at horse races. They could not be expected, of course, to give up funerals, but they should transform funerals, which were now the occasion for conspicuous display and consumption of imported finery, leather gloves, laces, imported black cloth and jewelry, transform those occasions into occasions of conspicuous non-consumption, where you had simple little bands of mourning on your clothing, where only gloves that were worn or given by the family of deceased were those made locally, or at least by colonial glovers. In short, they would transform occasions at which the elite most conspicuously set themselves off from their inferiors with their clothing, style, money, and access to English gentility, and express in symbolic terms their solidarity with their lesser neighbors. The elite had to exhibit their virtue. And I just want to give one example. Marylander Daniel Delaney suggested one such occasion when he encouraged the political leaders in that colony to appear in homespun rather than their usual clothing more fit for gentlemen. He said, and I quote, "The sight of our representatives all adorned in complete dresses of their own leather and flax and wool would excite not the gaze of admiration, the flutter of an agitated imagination, or the momentary amusement of a transient scene, but a calm, solid, heartfelt delight." Here was a claim for a symbolic presentation of the rulers, expressing their sameness with those beneath them in the social scale, their solidarity. It's not just symbolic, because, of course, these things were not actually the fruits of these gentlemen's work. They were the fruits of the labor of working people in the colonies. And although that meant enslaved working people in some colonies, in many places, it meant country women, farm women, who would be reaping the benefits of new demands for homespun, as well as working men, leather dressers, tailors, and others. So there's that switch from what a later generation would call conspicuous consumption to a conspicuous non-consumption. You had to prove it if you were a member of the elite. You had to defer to self-created groups called Sons of Liberty, and then later to locally elected bodies chosen to enforce and oversee the trade boycotts and determine and pronounce upon the patriotism of all inhabitants. Merchants, of course, were to stop importing from English merchants and manufacturers in general, especially tea, cloth, expensive furnishings, and a whole list of other items. Every person of means was either to consume fewer goods or different goods. They were to recreate and reclaim the horizontal ties of neighborhood, community, and countrymen and deal with one another, help their neighbors get out of debt. A virtuous patriot who had the wherewithal to purchase goods was to put his bunny in the pocket of his lesser neighbors. And beyond that, a virtuous merchant or retailer would be very careful not to take advantage of the common crisis or the shortage of goods caused by the boycotts and by raising prices on scarce goods on hand. I've said these became less and less voluntary. Not to take part was to incur the wrath of these self-appointed groups and one's neighbors, to be called before a committee to answer for your habits and your behavior. And if you did not answer the committee successfully, possibly to be published in the press. Your name would be published in the press, and you would be excluded from all trade and interaction. The central element here that secures virtue is something we might call publicity or publicness. To read the papers at this time is to read about countless committee meetings and occasions on which people could be viewed. The committee meetings were not just committee men, but they were widely open to the public and, as the people who didn't like them said, the mob. Newspaper reported announcements of committee's findings, and they became filled with accusations and apologies, statements of virtue, names of violators of the boycotts or non-associators. People who wouldn't take part were listed. As one committee said in the Massachusetts paper, quote, because after all the friendly expostulations we have made to him, end quote, he refused to agree to the resolutions of any committees and congresses. So he was called for this, quote, unfriendly to the liberties of the people. These newspapers and handbills denouncing you as unfriendly to the liberties of the people might be posted up in every tavern or public house, at every country mill, and along city streets. So this publicness or oversight of everyone by everyone else, or of free people by other free people, was extensive. Moreover, economic acts in particular fell under jurisdiction of the public. Public virtue extended to and perhaps even centered in acts that a later age would consider private ones and would call economic acts, not political acts. In this view of the world, patriots' view, neighbors had a stake in their neighbors' choices of consumption and purchasing and pricing, whether men drank tea in the parlor or rum with their fellows in the tavern or the militia muster, whether merchants raised prices on scarce goods, whether women purchased cloth or produced it in the neighborhood. These choices all became subject to public knowledge, public discussion, and sometimes public discipline. Virtuous Americans did more than put their own self-interest second. They recognized that there existed no strictly or merely economic acts at all. The social and political implications of such acts were laid bare for everyone to see and widely acknowledged. Patriots admitted that their business was the business of their neighbors. They recognized and accepted the jurisdiction even of ordinary men. And although at the outset those elected to committees tended to be local leaders, men who had served in local positions before, over time they came to include more and more people who hadn't, more and more men who hadn't served. And beyond that, as I mentioned, many people could attend committee meetings. Even a servant, say, could report a violator of the pact to the committee, and women participated as well, which is a true sign of the breadth of the publicness. How central these principles were becomes clear from the objections of some colonists that made loudly against them. You can read any number of people objecting to this intrusion into their lives, and you can sympathize with them. One Connecticut lady described the activities of committees of inspection as, quote, prying into the conduct of individuals, which I think is true. You can just imagine what it would be like to be called up for drinking tea in your own parlor. Would drive you crazy. Of course, it makes you a Tory if that drives you crazy, not a patriot. As some Americans complained, there didn't seem to be space for individual conscience or opinion. And some didn't accept the oversight, especially by their inferiors or those inferiors' involvement in political affairs. Many had no intention of forgoing tea in their select circles of private parlors, or replacing it with rum, which they would have to consume cheek by jowl with the clownish rough herd. I always like the notion of the herd of people. They just lay it right out, those attitudes in the 18th century. One William Ragg in South Carolina considered it foolish to forgo ostentatious consumption and glove-giving at funerals. Shouldn't people exhibit a decent external sorrow? And as for reformulating class relationships, he didn't want to give up tea and replace it with rum. He had another idea of virtue. What if the tradesmen of Charleston gave up rum and took up tea instead? Then, quote, instead of receiving the offense by passing the doors of numberless dram shops, the bane of all order and sobriety, I shall with pleasure enter the decent habitations of honest mechanics. Juxtaposing William Ragg's view of virtue with its emphasis on sobriety, order, and social hierarchy makes clear the radicalism and distinctiveness of patriot views. Here's another Carolinian, William Henry Drayton. His objections to the boycott was the movement of power to the lesser people, who he felt were simply not competent. These agreements, he complained, had not been formed primarily by leading men, not by the South Carolina legislature, although many of those men did sign these agreements. Rather, these agreements had been formed in negotiation with tradesmen and mechanics, shoemakers and petty retailers, all of whom gathered at Liberty Tree to confer with their social betters and to put pressure on their social betters to increase the terms of the boycott. The resulting boycotts were too deferential to such Americans' interests, ideas of fairness, economic justice, and their fears about the rich and ambitious. Indeed, the patriot boycotts embodied a rather clear suspicion of elites and the whole class accustomed to serving as rulers and representatives. Patriots did not consider that suspicion class warfare, but class realism. The ambitious would try to pile up riches, purchase office for themselves and their families. And here is the way that one almanac from Massachusetts described the purpose of the patriot movement. It's, quote, to prevent the execution of that detestable maxim of European policy amongst us, namely, that the common people, who are three-quarters of the world, must be kept in ignorance that they may be slaves to the other quarter, who live in magnificence. So it was a movement against magnificence and against ignorance, for publicness, for virtue. Patriots sought to create a virtuous network, a society that would fend off arbitrary power. Now, there was in all this one concept which has become rather rare in U.S. society in following centuries, and that is the concept of enough. They called it a competence, and the historian Daniel Vickers has written brilliantly on this. The economic goal for many northern farmers in particular that he's looked at was not endless amounts of gain. That wasn't even a vaguely realistic goal, but what they called a competence. Enough land, enough tools, enough property to absorb the labor of your household, all your kids, all and your wife, and enough to live well, to pass something on to them, the opportunity for them to be independent of the labor market, and then perhaps a little bit more, perhaps a little bit of that tea, perhaps a little bit of those fine things. You had to have this notion of enough in order to label imports fripperies and luxuries and baubles. You had to have a concept of enough in order to counter an ideal that boundless ambition would enslave Americans. The idea that when ambitions are boundless, your neighbors are in danger. That fear that we have neighbors who wish to, as one put it, reduce us to lordships, that is, create in America a system of magnificent lords and poor people. That's very powerful. Well, briefly, how does this notion of virtue that I'm finding in the patriot movement, how does that relate to the Constitution and to Madison's argument? Well, in the 1770s and 80s, of course, the states formed constitutions. And as the result of patriot ideology and of the mobilization of many middling political actors and their keen concern for virtue in their republics, the new state constitutions put substantially greater power in the hands of middling men. They shifted power from the executive and the upper house to the lower house. They established, in many cases, more frequent elections. Some established broader suffrage, and all established broader oversight, literally in the sense of building public galleries where you could go and watch what your legislators were doing. newspaper reports on what your legislators had done, so the people would know how's your representative doing. The idea was to establish governments or in states that would respond to popular notions of fairness and equity, governments that were accountable. As a result, the states, in fact, pursued policies that reflected, to some degree, the interests and ideas of virtue held by more ordinary Americans. They adopted popular, arguably equalizing policies that favored debtors, that opposed the concentration of wealth and power through the society, and that prevented the return of one-time Tories into their societies. By the 1780s, there's something of reaction to all this. And Madison and his fellows are out to walk a very fine line in forming the Constitution. First, there's very much an effort to depoliticize many people. They want to readmit many conservative former Tories who will be wealthy, who will tend to vote on a more conservative side to society. They want to place issues and decisions beyond the reach of easy majorities. And they want to convince the populace at large, the middling and lesser people especially, to become less vigilant, more trusting, less concerned, they might have said obsessed, with oversight over their rulers. They also wanted to depoliticize many aspects of life, particularly the economic, buying and selling. The Federalists aimed at creating a federal government which would be routinely and reliably dominated by elites and create a space in which those elites could rule significantly less encumbered by popular oversight. This was the ideal of many. The historian Alfred Young gives the example of Alexander Hamilton, who in June of 1787 gave a five-hour speech in which he spelled out what kind of government he thought they should form. He's in the middle of the convention. This is not a public speech. It's to his fellows at the convention. He would not necessarily have said this in public. He said, among other things, all communities divide themselves into the rich and the well-born on the one hand and the mass of the people on the other. The mass of the people, quote, seldom judge or determine right. He wanted something as close as possible to the British system of kings, lords, and commons. This was the best model the world has ever produced. This is in 1787, 11 years after the Declaration of Independence. He wanted a Senate and President elected for life, elected popularly by the voters, but for life during good behavior. They could be impeached. With a lower house elected every 3 years, the President would have an absolute veto, no overriding it, of any law. He would appoint the governors of the states, and they could veto any law passed by the states. William Samuel Johnson, 3 days later, said, "This speech has been praised by everybody. But then he said, "Hamilton has been supported by no one." Hamilton then went off for about a month and left the convention, came back and supported it in the end. His views were too conservative, or maybe too radical. I'm not sure how to quite think of them. But he wasn't entirely unrepresentative. It's just these sorts of things were understood as not being possible. And they weren't possible because you had to get the Constitution ratified and people had to accept it. And the people weren't about to accept something so monarchical and British at that moment. So the Constitution did not set up that system. It didn't limit the vote, as many would have preferred, and roll it back because you needed the voters to vote for it. The proposed Constitution did, in fact, shift powers from the states into a new federal government. It removed such capacities from states as the right to coin money and create legal tender. It insulated economic and financial policies, in particular, from the influence of the majority. And it made a government that would be substantially less responsive to popular majorities and popular opinion than the states had shown themselves to be. It was a compromise. It involved different notions of revolutionary virtue, including a great deal of popular oversight. What Gary Wills is pointing to, therefore, it seems to me, is this contradiction in Madison's writing, or in fact, the kind of sleight of hand that Madison's trying to carry out in his argument in The Federalist. He's trying to reassure doubters and skeptics that they can trust the men they'll put into power in the new federal system. After all, I mean, aren't we virtuous enough? They will be virtuous because the voters are virtuous. The voters will choose men who will not tyrannize. that voters will choose men who will not be corrupted by money or position. But at the same time, he's moving power away from those supposedly vigilant and virtuous voters and assuring elites that their class will be doing most of the ruling. I think there's a twofold inheritance here. The Constitution goes some way, some distance in insulating rulers. But at the same time, there are elements of the Constitution deeply dedicated to maintaining a virtuous republic in terms recognizable to the revolutionary generation. In particular, in the Bill of Rights, adopted at the insistence of people who opposed the Constitution and the new federal order to placate and secure their support, we see protection of close-to-the-ground institutions, churches, militias, and juries, through which people might formulate and act to express their ideals about what was good and what was fair. And most of all, I think, in the First Amendment, we see the Constitution providing for the fundamentally public nature of the republic. The freedom of the press is the means through which people will maintain claims on their rulers, whether old elite or new ones, and maintain oversight over their government and the prospect of a renewed fiscal and military state. Thank you.
I think it's appropriate to remind all of us that the 18th century was a time of tremendous change. It's a time of tremendous economic change, tremendous social change, and, of course, tremendous ideological change. During the 18th century, conceptions of self changed, conceptions of God, conceptions of political legitimacy, conceptions of the of society, and certainly of the proper society. During the late 18th century, these changes were, if anything, accelerated. And certainly the revolutions both in this country and in France give evidence as to the extent of change that was occurring and the extent of change that was occurring within people's minds and people's attitudes. The relationship, yes, I'm sorry, speak up. The relationship of the individual to society, the relationship of the individual to the state are two key aspects representative of this change. Virtue, as to some degree a definition of one's relationship to society, changed as well during this era. And I'm going to be arguing today that it changed substantially even during the revolutionary era, changed substantially from the period of time from the 1760s until the 1780s and 1790s. In this context, I don't see the Constitution so much as a conservative reaction to the revolution, but rather as more of a fulfillment of the growth of liberal ideas, the change in virtue to embrace a liberalism rooted in a rights orientation and an individualism that was only beginning to be understood and endorsed in the early revolutionary era. We have to look at virtue in the context of republican self-government. By the 1770s, there had been two earlier experiments with republican self-government that Americans had understood, one in ancient Rome, the other among the city-states in early modern Italy. Both had failed. Both had failed, at least in large part, to the corruption of the individuals who composed that society, and arguably the corruption of those individuals who were designated as leaders within those societies. For Americans, therefore, the idea of virtue was a necessary construct with which to protect the potential for self-rule from the corruption of the people that may destroy it before it was even freeborn, if you will. In this context, this historical context, virtue assumed a tremendous importance during the early revolutionary years. The question was, and I think Barbara stated it very well, are Americans virtuous enough to be worthy of a republic? One of our leading intellectual historians, Gordon Wood from Brown University for many, many years, defines two forms of virtue that he identifies in the early years of the American Revolution, one which he refers to as public virtue. And this is what Barbara was referring to, I think in most part at least. the need for individuals to subordinate some of their own interests to the good of the whole. It's a recognition that such a thing as public good exists, that the social whole as an integrity, has an integrity, as an identifiable unit. Public virtue understands that people are parts of this whole, that they compose the whole, and that their own selfish interests may be a factor in destroying the society, or at least the free exercise of political rights that a republic would create. Another form of virtue is private virtue. This is basically derived from the old Platonic maxim, those of you who have read The Republic, that he who refuses to govern must be prepared to be governed by one less capable than himself. There was an understanding in earlier America that there are some people with greater potential for government, for leading, than other potential. People with greater skills, perhaps greater intelligence, perhaps less inclined to be persuaded or overcome by corruption that might turn one away from the best interests of the community. This was understood as private virtue, that virtue which would compel someone, frequently at great personal expense in terms of lifestyle, relationships with family members and the like, to assume positions in government for the sake of the community as a whole. Both of these conceptualizations of virtue are relatively new to the late 18th century. The underlying premise is that the state, neither the state nor the church, can compel virtue. We forget today just what a radical concept this was. For the state, throughout most of modern Europe, and in fact, throughout most of medieval Europe, the state and the church had worked together to do just that, to compel virtue. If the state and the church were, first of all, perhaps not going to be integrated, and secondly, not going to have as one of its goals the perpetuation or creation of virtue, then how in the world, in a republic, are we going to maintain a society with sufficient virtue to assume the responsibility for self-government? It's this question that brings into focus the initial question with which Barbara started, that being, what is the nature of man? Enlightenment thought reconceived of man, reconceived of his nature, from the Calvinist or Protestant conception of man, perhaps even the Christian conception of man, as born with original sin, perhaps at least inclined to sin, in need of structure, in need of rules and regulations, of authority to keep him on a straight path and a moral path. Enlightenment thought reconceived of man as reasonable, rational, and benevolent, imbued with an internal moral compass that each individual had at birth and that would guide him or her throughout his or her life. It was in reliance upon this natural benevolence, this internal moral compass, that people could extract virtue from the domain of political authority or church responsibility. Virtue became a matter of individual responsibility, sacrificing voluntarily, not by social imposition, but voluntarily sacrificing one's interests and desires for the good of the whole, or voluntarily assuming responsibility for government when your nation, your state, or your locality called upon you for the talents that you brought to the job. The recognition that this morality, if you will, this virtue, this republican morality, could not be compelled is recognized in the words of Adam Smith, of course a contemporary with those figures who were the founders of the American Revolution, writing in England during the same time period. From his theory of moral sentiments, I quote, "Beneficence is always full. It cannot be extorted by force. The mere want, or lack, of it exposes to no punishment, because the mere want of beneficence tends to do no real positive evil. Virtue must be voluntary. It is even conceived as a natural commitment of republican citizens." This conception of virtue goes hand in glove with another movement which defines late 18th century American society. That is the secularization of American society. It's helpful to understand that colonial American society was very, very different from the society that resulted from the Revolution, that in many ways grew out of the Revolution. Not only was it hierarchical, not only was it highly structured, as hierarchical societies are, but it was communitarian. It perceived Americans during the colonial era, really up through, in fact, the 1750s and 1760s, perceived of their communities as social units. During the Revolution and the Constitutional era, we redefined the primary social unit from the community or the family to the individual. Individuals became responsible for politics, for economics, for religion, as the primary unit. Each individual had responsibility for his own economic welfare, for his own political voice, for his own religious beliefs. And in this transformation from communitarianism to individualism, the church was reconceived from a public to a private institution, forced to assume the corporate form, and forced to the periphery of public or institutional life in post-revolutionary America. This could not have occurred but for the earlier transformation of religion from a public truth to a matter of personal conscience. In recognizing that each individual had an internal moral compass, was blessed with a natural benevolence, not by necessarily God, but by the laws of nature, responsibility for belief, for moral action, came from within, not from without. Numerous writers, thousands of Americans, accepted this idea of religious belief as a matter of conscience, coming from within, controlled not by any external authority, and not even needing to comply with the dictates of a greater being. There was no need to find religion as something which is outside of oneself, but rather to look within oneself to find one's own beliefs. This transformation of religious truth from a matter of public dictate to a matter of personal conscience coincides with this conception of virtue as a matter of personal responsibility, individual responsibility necessary for the fulfillment of the Republican ideal. In colonial America, it's hard to conceive of virtue without such concepts as Christian morality, Christian duty, social deference, even piety, finding their way into the conversations. Yet throughout all the debates on virtue in the Revolutionary and Constitutional era, those comments from the clergy and from like-minded individuals were, for the most part, shunted off to the rear. They were not at the pivotal decision-making crux of the Revolutionary era and constitutional debates on the matters of virtue. Certainly there were class distinctions. It's inappropriate, I think, to refer to Ciceroian conceptions of virtue and the need for virtue in a republic and assume that tens of thousands of Americans working in their own fields or attending their own stores embraced these concepts. Certainly there were an elite, or there was an elite within American society that understood Cicero to be a prophet of the Roman Republic's decline, and to see in his warnings the potential for failure within the American Republican experiment. Certainly many of these people were able to debate virtue at a relatively esoteric level, and to conceive of virtue as something that was the responsibility of each individual within a republic to preserve and to act upon. Virtue was understood differently by different people. People without perhaps that degree of education, perhaps without that degree of interest in academic scholarship, did understand virtue in more behavioralistic terms, the type of virtue that was manifest in the boycotts, that was manifest in the embrace of simplicity, the preference of homespun garments as expressions of virtuous behavior. This eschewment of luxury and corruption is part of a broader movement throughout American society to reject artificiality, to reject artificiality in terms of an artificial aristocracy. Jefferson spoke of a natural aristocracy, that aristocracy which would come to economic wealth, that would come to political power by virtue of its talent, by virtue of its effort, as opposed to by virtue of its birth or its inheritance. This natural aristocracy was consistent with Enlightenment conceptions of natural law, legal equality, equal opportunity within the society to pursue one's desires, to pursue social desires through the cumulative efforts of individuals pursuing their own. This is a late revolutionary conception of virtue, one that many historians today recognize as liberalism. This conception of virtue that was rooted in this behavior before the revolution in the 1760s and 1770s was ultimately transformed through the revolution and post-revolutionary experience into a reconceptualization of natural law expressed and recognized through man's laws, a structure of a legal system that would ultimately take the place of social deference, hierarchy, and the rule of men in colonial society. This emphasis on legalism in the 1790s and even the late 1780s diminished the emphasis on virtue. The rise of liberalism can be seen as the rise of a legalistic society, emphasizing rights as opposed to social duties. It is part and parcel of this transformation from colonial society and its hierarchical communalistic nature to modern society with its legalistic and individualistic nature. In this modern society, of which the Constitution I see is a very critical step in this movement, it's recognized not only that laws cannot compel virtue, but that laws serve a negative function of protecting individuals from any force in the society that might try and impose virtue upon them. Think of the Bill of Rights. The protections in that are all guaranteed to preserve individual freedoms, to protect individuals from the powers of the state, from the powers of any powerful group within society that might impose its will upon the people. Certainly one of those powers that was most feared during this time was the powers of the church. Church had been a tremendous power in European society for hundreds and hundreds of years. Powers of the state, the powers of any group that would try and impose a moral value, a virtue, a duty, an obligation upon individuals who had none, but their own duties, their own obligations to fulfill their own desires and their own interests. This change in American society was ultimately embraced by Thomas Jefferson and further during his administration after the election of 1800. Jefferson argued that there was no such thing as a public good. It was an artificial concept, artificial as monopolies were, artificial as an artificial aristocracy was, as artificial as the monarchs were. This conception of the public good could only be realized, if it could be realized at all, in the exercise of each individual seeking his own private good in his own private ways. Laws came to compel not so much the acceptance of public values, public virtues, but rather the acceptance of a personal space in which to pursue one's own goals, recognizing that coincident with the protection of one's own space was the need of each individual within the society to respect the space of others, to respect his equal legal rights. This became virtue in the 1790s and early 1800s, not the imposition of one's own ideas or general social ideas upon the masses, but rather the respect of other people not having the same ideas, the same motivations, the same values, drives, religious beliefs, and respecting that as the autonomy that would ultimately define liberal America.
I'm sure you will agree with me that this is a remarkable, remarkable instruction in the nature of ourselves as citizens. I suspect there are many questions, and I have some also, but I'll defer. We have 10 or 15 minutes. I'm sure that people will want to write books, but I think we'll want to talk more. And so may I open, they will continue to talk to each other and to us, but may I open now the floor to the audience and let you ask your questions.
It seems to me we've gotten about as bad as we're going to get, and I don't know what it's going to take to make people, I don't know, be nice again. I really don't. I'm from across the mountain, and we're developing a saying over there, you drive like you're from Charlottesville. And so I'm wondering where this does edge out historically.
Well, we're extremely knowledgeable about the 18th century. The 21st is really, really a tougher one. It is incredible how resonant some of this language is. It is extraordinary to sit and read 18th century documents and say, and you know, that's archaic language. You can't quite get it. They use language you wouldn't, but you think, whoa, that's recognizable, that issue. And I just, there's one thing I thought I'd read, which is from this quoted in the Norwich, Connecticut Packet and Rhode Island Weekly Advertiser from 1776, talking about the corruption of England. And this isn't to say, answer your question, I just think it resonates with issues that we are in the midst of or that you hear around you today. You just have to change the language. I'm just going to read the briefest part of it. It says, one would think from the late tenor of public proceedings that the wisdom of the present day meant seriously to deny that the great object of government was public good. If this were not the case, the welfare of the people would claim a much larger share of ministerial attention that it now enjoys. It talks about mighty states of building up empires. The declensions of these mighty states may be uniformly traced to their departure from the principles of reciprocal affections. When the government, which used to be open, simple, and natural, became a complicated, intriguing cabinet, when the ministers became rich and the people poor, when the rulers got power at the expense of people's freedom, it was then that the sun of their splendor begun his retrogradation. It says, people have now become so inconsequential in the eyes of administration that they are not thought worthy of being treated with common civility. Every account of public affairs that is given by authority is cooked with so much art and garnished with so much fraudulent chicanery. Their taskmasters are not contented. It is not sufficient to them that the people are inactive. They must be silent also and not presume to speak their opinions of measure far above their comprehension. Well, there's in that 18th century language, it strikes me, there's just so many notions of terrible decline, of a government that doesn't care, of a total lack of affection, of people who are not not just inactive, but silent. And I guess the only consolation is they felt that way about it in 1776, or they were worried about that in 1776, and they did find ways to do something about it, and that too did pass. But it's very much the kind of resonates very much, I think, with your concerns about how do we reconnect, or is there some way we could imagine virtue in today's society.
Of course, the way they found something to do about it might be different than what we feel is open to ourselves today.
Right. No, I would contend that, and Barbara and I talked about this briefly in talking to one another about what we might address today, and one of the things that I've argued for many years and played around with for many years is that America has a dual intellectual heritage. We certainly cannot recognize ourselves as having anything but a Christian heritage, a Protestant Christian heritage, perhaps even a Calvinist heritage. At the same time, certainly the Revolution was fought in an era of tremendous secularism. Enlightenment truths were certainly at the basis of much of the revolutionary movement, and we can probably argue among ourselves to the extent. But if you think of the Enlightenment and the humanistic impulses which it wrought, the emphasis on man is reasonable, rational, and benevolent. The recognition that man is basically capable of governing himself, conforming to natural laws, and needs no tremendous authority in order to do so. That is certainly contrasted with a conception of man that, if not born with original sin, certainly is inclined to evil, that needs to conform to moral dictates given to him by a supreme being and enforced through representatives of that being here on earth in partnership with the church or with some other civil society. These conceptions of man and his role to society, I think, remain present in all Americans. Some of us may be 99.